Everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Bowhunter Chronicles podcast brought to you by Tacticam. Tacticam is by far the easiest way to begin filming your hunts. Whether it's the budget-friendly solo or the 4K 5.0, Tacticam has something for everyone. Check them out at tacticam.com. This year, we're also working with Spartan Forge. Spartan Forge is military tracking technology for the deer woods. It provides up-to-date information on deer predictions and movements, along with some of the best imaging in the industry. The predictions that are on there, it tells you if the deer are going to be in the core area in a full range, if they're going to be active, if they're going to be kind of sticking right around their bedding areas. It kind of gives you an idea of where to hunt and how to gauge deer movement. For example, this past weekend, it was a full range day. Deer were going to be active. Set on Spartan Forge, went out and I saw three different bucks, a larger buck, and actually the buck that I had hit earlier this year fighting, a third buck with him, and I saw a multitude of other does. And then I did some driving around and saw two really great bucks. And just, it's been fairly accurate for me, but it gives you that little bit of confidence of when to spend your precious time in the woods. You can check them out at spartanforge.ai, and if you go online, you can use code BOWHUNTER to save 25%. spartanforge.ai. Gotta give a quick shout out to one of our newest Patreons. No new ones this past week, but TJ Recipco. So he's been hunting. This is his second year hunting. He shot his first deer, and it was a buck, and it was a monster buck. Just a huge shout out. He did shoot it with a rifle or a shotgun because he's in Ohio, and I don't want him to get down on that. You know, in the Marco Polo group for the Patreons, we've been, you know, some of the guys were saying, you know, we've all killed deer with a gun, and you got to get a few under your belt, etc. But man, this kid is, he's a guy, whatever. He's screwed because this buck is a monster. And just quick shout out to TJ. Congrats on that. And Patreon, if you're not familiar, is crowdfunding for creators. So basically, it helps us buy equipment to record this podcast. I just ordered today for the new studio where I'm sitting in right now, waiting to paint some mounts for the cameras, for the computer, for the recorder. It allows us to do stuff like that, hunts, gear. This next podcast that John and I are going to be recording, it's going to be a video podcast. We are going over the Eberle Stock X2 Badlands Super Day. I have the SOG Op Ord Trophy Line K's, Trophy Line Plateau Pack. My dad out west used the Mystery Ranch Pop-Up 38. John and I are not a fan of the Mystery Ranch Pop-Up 28. Some people use it, but it's one of those packs that shows up. The 38, I think, will be a little bit better suited the way that it's set up, but I think it takes a little bit of finessing if you're going to use that pack. But then we also have like the pack that I used out west was the Sawtooth from Mystery Ranch, John's XO, and then John has, I don't think they make it anymore, it's not the Monster fanny pack from Badlands, but it's a very similar one, and he had been using that saddle hunting. And that's one of the questions that we get is, what about these packs? What about these packs? You know, where to spend your money? And so from that, we are going to be giving away for our quarterly giveaway, which ends end of the year. So as soon as after the first of the year, we'll announce the winners from the Patreons, is one of the Eberle Stock X2s. And one of the other things we get a lot of questions on is releases. Releases are expensive. People don't want to try them. So we've got a Carter Evolution, which is the same as John and I use the Silverbacks from Knock-On. But basically, that's just a John Dudley's take on this Carter Evolution. So we're going to be giving away one of those. And then the Tacticam Reveal cell cams had incredible success with those this year, especially in areas where you would want a cell camera. So cell cameras are great for real-time data, but they're also great for places where you can't get to. We're giving away one of the Tacticam Reveal SKs. That one has the battery pack. It has the built-in solar panel, and that solar panel comes with a longer cord, so you can mount the camera here. Maybe not facing the sun, because I have one up in the UP that is facing to the south, and as the sun comes up and it changes light through the trees, I'm getting false pictures on it because I've got it set too high. But you can change that solar panel, move it around so it is in the sun if you're in an area that doesn't get a lot of sun. And that one does come with both of the SIM cards for Verizon and AT&T. So you can choose whichever area has the better service up for you. So I'm running, and you can run, if you're running multiple cameras, they don't have to be on the same thing. So I'm running some Verizon and some AT&T based on the areas that we're at. So we're giving away all that stuff to a couple of the different patrons. We'll do a drawing. Spartan Forge also gives away a year subscription to their service, as well as our friends over at Zinger Fletchings, 3D printed compression fit fletchings, give away some of those. So if you want to check out any of that, if you want to support the show, if you want to help us, you can go to bowhunterchroniclespodcast.com and click on the Patreon link. You can find the link in our Instagram, or you can go to patreon.com/bowhunterchroniclespodcast. But if that's not your thing, no big deal. Just tell somebody about the episode. This episode is great. Michigan guy, Blake Mallory, literally wrote a book. It's on Amazon. And I didn't even realize this. I've got links in the show notes. It's a very inexpensive book on Amazon. However, if you have a Kindle or an e-reader, you can download it for free. So this information is out there for free. Blake's not trying to make any money off of it. It's just something that he wanted to share his experiences and to see if he could do it. But it's hunting out of state on a budget. And there's a lot of guys that haven't ever hunted out of state or planned one of these trips. And there's a lot of great points in here, from the size of your hunting party, where even numbers and even number of vehicles are better, cost, hunting style, what states to go through. I think you guys are really going to like this. Thank you, thank you, thank you for listening. Hey, everybody. Adam back with another episode of the Bowhunter Chronicles podcast. And today, this is a topic I think that a lot of people maybe are nervous about. Maybe they don't know where to start. Maybe they're afraid of the cost. But we're going to talk about DIY out-of-state hunting, kind of with a purpose and on a budget. And we're talking with Blake Mallory. And if you're watching this on YouTube, we're doing this on Zoom, so we can see the wall of mounts and deer and all sorts of stuff Blake's got behind him. But he has literally written the book on how to destination hunt deer on a budget. So how are you doing tonight, Blake?
Good, good. Excited to be on and excited to talk about hunting at any time. So
it seems like for most of us, talking about hunting is probably more, I mean, I guarantee if you asked our wives that it would be like, it's all we talk about, right? So, I mean, now you're getting to do it like in an official capacity, like, honey, I have to go downstairs and talk about hunting now. Like,
oh yeah. Yeah, for sure. And still get the eye rolls every time we talk about hunting with them. But, it's kind of nice to be able to have an excuse to talk about it.
So what's your story as far as like, where are you from and how did you grow up hunting?
Yeah. So, I'm from West Michigan. We had a family cabin up in northern Michigan, and basically, you know, grew up shooting spikes and 4 points and 6 points with the family on the family cabin. Probably around about 16 years old, my family one of my uncles started to put together hunting in Canada. And we kind of started to hunt in Canada, and then we did it with a guide 1 year, and then we kind of started to do our own thing. And then when I was about 20, 21, somewhere in there, we there was a big winter kill up in Canada, and the deer hunt got real slow. And I was just like, there's got to be other options, because that was all we knew about hunting outside of the state of Michigan. And so I started to really look into other avenues about hunting other places. And the first hunt I ever put together, I would say it was probably about 21, was a bow hunt in Ohio. So that was about 15, 16 years ago now. And it was pretty nerve wracking putting together a hunt for, you know, uncles and all the guys that were older than me. And that's kind of where it stemmed from. You know, just grew up hunting around farms around my house and the family cabin up north.
Okay. So I look at things from a perspective of like, do I really want to subject myself to that? Right. And so there's hunts, and I actually had a conversation about this with my wife about like hunting Africa. Right. So she's like, well, you're just out there and they're just pointing stuff out and then you're just shooting it. And I'm like, well, it's a target rich environment. You know, you're getting a lot of experience. Maybe you've never been to Africa. So, you know, there's a lot of different factors that come in. We got a podcast with our friend Billy talking about going down there and hunting out of a saddle and killing things in Africa and everything that goes with that. But it doesn't really do anything for me. And I would say that maybe Canada's like that for me too. And like in the book, you talk about like Canada being like a hunt where maybe you see one deer and you freeze your balls off and like all of these things. And like, so was your experience like from the get go, that great as far as like, was it like big deer or what kept you going after that? Because it seems like that would be a hunt where it would you'd really have to be like a serious hunter, or it would have to be like something, some sort of a catalyst to be like, now I need to do this a lot. Cause it's from what I've seen from my friends that have done it, you know, it's like you sit in a blind, there's like freaking a bale of alfalfa out there and you wait to see like what comes in. Right.
Yeah. So you say hunt Canada and that's what you think of. That is not what we did. It was, it's one of the roughest hunts. So like the year we're the guide, we're talking, there's a lot of definitions of hunting with a guide. This is a very, marginal hunting with a guide situation. This was a platform nailed to a tree back on public land. And you got a bucket and went and sat in it all day from sun up to sundown. And you might see a deer. That was basically the hunting with a guide there. So no bale hay, none of that, not seeing, you know, letting three bucks walk and picking which one you want to kill. That was not the situation. That's why we kind of went there, did that. We were successful. We shot 4 for 4, I think, you know, a couple 130s. I think mine was like 110. I was 16. It was the last day. But then we kind of basically looked into it, and this is Ontario, and we decided that we could kind of do this, and we got hooked up with a guy up there that had a cabin, and we kind of knew some of the area, so we'd go up there and we'd scout for a couple of days before we started hunting. The thing that brought us back was we did run into 170s. We did shoot a couple 170s, a couple 150s. I think I shot one that was just about 160 up there. So when you did connect, that was what kept you on stand for so long. I mean, basically up there, the one thing is 10 to 2, that's when you're going to kill your big ones. You're not going to kill it right before dark. You're not going to kill it first thing in the morning. It was one of the hardest hunts. I mean, when I started hunting other places, going to Ohio, it was like hunting in paradise. You know, see deer consistently, higher deer numbers. I want to say like in the area that the locals were saying like 7 out of 10 deer die without ever seeing a human in those areas. There's just so few deer numbers in the area that we were hunting, but that was, you know, I took a lot of that into when I set up hunts and stuff is basically, you know, how hard you're willing to work at something is how successful you're going to be. And same thing with up in Canada, if you were willing to say, you know, if you didn't get down at noon and go eat a sandwich, you had a lot higher chance of killing a big buck up there. But yeah, it was brutal. You know, we, but when it was its heyday, you know, we had one trip, I think we had 8 or 9 guys and we all tagged out. The last guy came down the last day, but everybody filled the tag. And so it was pretty good hunting. Even though it was brutal at times with how cold it was.
So talk to me a little bit about that, because when, for most people in Michigan and the way that you've outlined that, saying, you know, we shot spikes, 4 points, 6 points, and then we went to Canada. You know, that if that 110 inch buck was the first buck that you saw, you probably would have shot him in heartbeat if you had never seen anything else. I mean, the first time I went to Ohio, we went and scouted Ohio. We saw some deer running around, but they're like, oh, there's 150s. There's big deer down here. You know, we saw some 130s, 140s, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, you know, cool. But in my mind, I couldn't quantify that, right? And so The first deer that I saw on stand in Ohio was 110, 115 inch 10 point, and I was like, okay,
yeah,
all right, yeah, all right, I can see how this would be fun. So to go to a place where, I mean, I can tell you that myself, I think I've probably seen a 170 or a 180, you know, in the dark driving back in Ohio. I've seen 2 deer that were just, I mean, mind-blowingly huge. But to see something like that on stand after going from shooting spikes and 4 points and 6 points, and I think that that's where a lot of our listeners are. Like, it's hard to put that into perspective, like, to see one of those and to see one on the hoof, you know?
Yeah, so the one thing is that I was on, like, I grew up watching my dads and my uncles and my grandpa shooting, you know, one horn spikes, 4 points, 6 points. I was right on that tail end when I got started in hunting. Cause when I got started hunting, you know, we could start hunting when we were 5, 6, 7, whatever they are now. It was 12. I could bow hunt for 12 and 13, and I could start gun hunting when I was 14. And so I would say about when I was about 14, 15 is when we really started to actually, we were kind of starting to turn the corner slightly into, you know, bigger 6 points or 8 points, 4 points on one side, that kind of thing. So I had started to shoot decent deer around that time I was going to Canada. So it wasn't that big of a jump, but however, had I have seen a 180 while I was on stand in Canada that first year, I would have fell out of my tree. But that didn't happen. Actually, that first year I went to Canada, I hunted sun up, sun down from Saturday to Friday, and I saw legs of one deer. It was like on Tuesday at noon. I never even saw his head. And then I saw the deer I shot on Friday, which was a small 110 inch 8 point. And I almost didn't shoot it. I had it right underneath me. I was going to let it go. And my dad's like, I would have kicked your butt if you would have let that go. Cause we've been hunting our tail off and I was the last one. The other guys had all shot. And I was 16. So everybody was happy for me and everything like that. And at that time, I mean, I still had shot quite a few bucks, but, I went to Canada to look for a 130 and I didn't connect, but I knew they were there. I mean, some of the guys that were in camp were from other places and stuff. And there was 150s, 160s, 170s hanging on. I think one guy did shoot a 180. He was definitely the VIP of the camp. You could tell the guide had his hand a little bit more all day and he was bouncing around and they were on some big deer. That's really the only guided hunt I've ever done. I guided after I graduated from Grand Valley, in natural resource management. I guided, myself, turkey and whitetail. And, that's where really going from, you know, seeing 110 or 130 inch deer and knowing if it's 110 or 130 inch deer really turned the corner for me. Cause I had to know how to age deer on hoof and score deer on hoof. So there was a lot of that really I learned. There's one of the senior guides that I learned basically almost everything I know about deer hunting to this day. I learned from that guy. That's where things really turned. But yeah, it was, I mean, you bring up a good point. I never thought about it that way, is going to Canada, hunt for 7 straight days and seeing one deer. Like, why would anybody, you know, want to do that again? But for some reason I did. I hunted Canada 5 or 6 times. And I still to this day, I got one buck that is probably the, actually he's right there on the video. He's just under 160. He's my top 2 bucks I've ever killed. And I shot him at 12:30 on a rainy, freezing rain day, freezing my tail off. I didn't think there was any chance I was going to make it all day. I was going to have to go back to the truck because it was one of the most blistering cold days I've been hunting, and I was wet to boot. So, it makes me appreciate a lot of these other states that I go to where, you know, I might see a dozen bucks in a week. Or, I think in the book I talk about the first trip I took to Iowa, I saw 85 different bucks in 16 days of hunting. And so, yeah, it definitely makes me appreciate a lot of these other hunts that I put together.
So that's one of the things I wanted to talk about was the, along with your hunting background, you know, so you did some guiding, you did some taxidermy, you still film, and you put out a couple of DVDs and things like that. So what's the process for becoming like a guide?
Honestly, it's pretty loose. People think that, you know, you need to go to guide school, you need to know this. Really, you need to get paid very, very poorly and be willing to work your tail off for about 18 hours a day. And that's what it came down to. When I guided, I was low man on totem pole. I guided.
Real quick though, like, how do you get into it? Like, so if you don't have to go to guide school or whatever, do you just like start printing off some business cards and say, hey, I'll take you to.
Well, if you want to guide for yourself, there might be different avenues to go to. But if you're guiding through some type of outfitter, you give them a call and you're willing to work for dirt cheap, they'll hire you. That's basically what it comes down to. When I interviewed with the place that I guided for, it was like, you know, can you lift a 50-pound bag? You willing to work hard? I mean, and then basically I got trained for about 3 weeks on how to score deer. How to age deer on the hoof, and still, like, you know, people think that they're experts on that. I worked with the experts who had been doing this for years, and they still got that stuff wrong on a daily basis. And there were still arguments about whether a deer was 3.5 or 5.5 on a daily basis. But really, I mean, if you want a guide, you know, start when you're 18, move out west. And I've got actually a buddy who's doing that right now. He works for a guide out in Iowa and Kansas, and he's busting his tail, and he's learning quickly on what it is. You know, it's a lot of hanging sets, a lot of holding rich people's hands, and gutting deer for people as well. So I mean, there's it's not a glamorous life. The one thing is I did it. I love guiding turkey hunt. That was a whole different ball game with calling and stuff. And I'm sure elk guiding is a lot different as well. You know, I love to hunt so much that you were making a living during hunt season. And there was very, very limited time. I think I got to hunt for about 2 weeks, and it was in late December. That year is all I got to hunt. And I actually put together a Ohio muzzleloader hunt because that was right after Christmas, and we were done guiding about the 20th of December. And my guiding background, it's you know, I ran a lot of corn feeders, you know, I ran a lot of you know, checking fences and running coyote traps. And I guided probably, I want to say about 8 or 9 bucks that we got killed, some decent ones, and had a successful turkey hunt that I guided. But short of that, it wasn't anything I was going to write a book on, or, you know, it seemed awesome. It seemed like what I wanted to get into until I actually dove into it. But I like to hunt too much to go down that avenue is where I basically put it when I decided to stop.
Well, I just want to put it in context because there's some things that you talk about in the book that I would never have thought of. And like I said, we talked prior to this, and the people that listen to the podcast have, probably heard I've hunted a few out of state DIY type stuff, and it's not what you know, it's who you know. And you meet that guy in the bar, or you meet this guy here, and then you get on this piece of property, whether it's public land that they hunt squirrels on, and it's got a lot of deer, they push a lot of deer around squirrel hunting, or they got 100 acres that nobody ever hunts, or my mom lives on our family farm and we quit hunting, that sort of thing. But again, like when people say like I'm a hunting guide, or I was a hunting guide, or you kind of laid it out like, I could guide people on my property in the UP because I've filled a corn feeder and I've done a lot of the things that you outlined there. But I would call myself not a guide. So it's interesting to think about. Maybe I think of more when you talk about a hunting guide in your mind, you have like the grizzly hunting guide with, the backup shotgun and, all of that sort of stuff.
And, that's completely different. Like, I swear, I think it's like down in, Pike County, Illinois, apparently, like when I started doing a lot of research and stuff, they said basically anybody who owns 10 acres is an outfitter. Because everybody, it was a destination that everybody wanted to go to Pike County, Illinois, because they were started killing big deer. And I guess there's bumper stickers that goes around and says, save a deer, shoot an outfitter. Like anybody can call themselves a guide. And, and it's unfortunate because there's a lot of guys that, they're like, okay, I live in Michigan, I want to go on an out of state hunt, and they don't know, who do you trust? How do you know that you go to this outfitter and it's not some guy who's got, some 50-year-old ladder stand, made out of wood inside a tree that's like, yeah, we used to kill deer back there. Give me $2,000 and good luck. See you next week. You drop that kind of money, your expectations are a lot higher. And that's where, I was very fortunate, and I talk about in the book, and the first hunt that I put together, I had a guide, an outfitter actually in Ohio. So what I did was I basically got on all these forums and I got on all these websites, and I basically put into these questionnaires, that I was like, I don't really want you to hang a stand for me. I don't even need a place to stay. I just kind of looking for a piece of land. And nobody for months reached back to me. And then I finally had one guy in Ohio reach out to me, and we talked. We ended up talking for like 2 weeks. And he was really, really cool. And he basically let me know that with a lot of these outfitters that start to get a little bit bigger, they never turn down a lease. They, if a piece of property comes up to lease, they take it because they're hoping to expand and grow and get more clientele. Well, some of these leases are so far away, they never have time to scout them. They never have time to hang sets. They just kind of keep them in their back pocket to always have. And that's where I kind of developed my view on talking with outfitters on how to get some of these pieces of property and stuff. And he ended up leasing a piece of property that he never had anybody hunt because it was so far from the lodge. Gave it to me really cheap. We went down on Thanksgiving week, with Thanksgiving right in the middle of the week, because nobody really wanted to do that. Everybody's spending time with their families and whatnot. And then he actually even hooked me up with a place to stay, like an Airbnb kind of thing. And it ended up working really well. The guy passed away before we came down there, but he gave me a lot of insight on how to deal with these outfitters. And when I'm looking for how I want to hunt, like I really don't. For me, I have nothing against somebody wanting to go sit in a box blind with a bale of hay in front of them and rifle through a bunch of deer and shoot the fifth buck that walks through. I don't have a problem with that. We're all on the same team. I like to do a lot of the stuff my own. I don't like I don't like going somewhere where they're like, you can only shoot a 135. And, you know, I don't want to be thinking about that when I'm looking down the barrel of a gun or looking at my bow sight, looking through my peep sight. Like that's not what I really want to look at. So that's why a lot of this stuff, when I do hunt private land in other places, you know, I like to be able to do my own thing and whatever the hunt dictates. You know, I went to North Dakota, I shot 100-inch 8-point, but busting my tail and there was guys dragging out 5 points and 4 points. And you know, that was what was getting shot in the area. And I was, it's still one of the bucks I'm most proud of, killed it off the ground. And, you know, it doesn't always come down to antler size for me. It comes down to experience and the story of the whole trip and what it comes together. So, but yeah, that's just kind of the insight with outfitters and, you know, almost anybody can become a guide, or let me rephrase that. Anybody can become a guide, just depending on how you want to do it. But anybody can call themselves an outfitter if they've got, you know, 40, 50 acres. It's just, they might not be a good one.
So, and that's kind of where I was going with this. And, you know, to this point, the listener, they're saying like, what the hell, man? Like, you're talking about guides and outfitters and we're trying to figure out how to do this DIY on a budget type stuff. And so have you used that strategy of hunting unused outfitter land since that one? And if so, how I almost feel like as technology has progressed and things have changed, like the forums have almost gone away, you know, to some degree. You know, everybody wants to just do everything on Facebook and Instagram and all these different avenues. So if you, so let's say that same Ohio hunt, like today, how would you go about trying to secure some private land if you were going to do that?
So I actually did it. I think it was 3 years ago. My buddy ended up shooting a nice 9-point and I misfired with a muzzleloader on a drop time buck. Basically Facebook. So, you know, I'm always looking for leases or, you know, anything that says lease or hunt for sale or, you know, hunting land, any kind of those avenues. And the one tip that I give in my book is that, you know, be willing to walk away. You know, you're not tied to anything. There's always public land down the road. You're going to work harder, obviously, if you're on public land. Ohio, you can bait. Late season, come, you know, muzzleloader season.
Just not private land.
Private. Right. Yeah. Right. If you're on private. And so you can't do that if you're on public. So obviously right there, I mean, you know, it gets a little harder. There's less cropland on public than, you know, so if you're late season hunt food source, you know, it gets a little bit easier, to hunt private, but being willing to walk away, what happened was, 3 years ago, Ohio muzzleloader hunt, saw a thing popped up. I think it was like $1,500 a guy, two guys on this property, DIY hunt. And I called them up and, basically I said, I think it was $400. I said, I'll give you $400 a guy to hunt the muzzleloader. And I said, I tell you what, I go, you can wait to the last minute and call me back if you don't fill it. You know, to them, $800 is better than nothing. Getting out of your property. And he ended up not even getting off the phone with me. He took it right there. So we went from $3,000 to $800 on the same piece of property, that we were going to hunt. And we ended up shooting one. It was still a tough hunt. It wasn't the easiest hunt, but, I did the same thing, with the first one that I put together. You know, I talked with the outfitter and I said, you know, what's a week that is still going to be halfway decent. Like everybody wants to go November 7th to November 14th. You know, you got rut going on. This was Thanksgiving week. Nobody wanted to hunt it. They can't fill it. So we got it a lot cheaper. I called another one and, I called about muzzleloader and he told me it was like $1,800 a guy to hunt this piece of private. And I said, I was like, you and I are on completely different worlds. Like, I'm like, we're not going to spend that. And, we started talking and I was like, well, what about late archery season? Well, in Ohio, you know, archery goes into February and He's like, I don't have anything. He goes, I tell you what, he goes, you can hunt any of my properties for $250 a guy and you can hunt it as long as you want. I'm like, sounds good. So I'm like, now you're talking my language. So we, you know, there's just, if you're willing to work, do a little bit of extra work and you're willing to walk away and not actually secure something, you know, there's opportunities out there for somebody. But yeah, Facebook, I use, honestly, the only reason I even have Facebook is for hunting stuff. Otherwise I wouldn't even have it. But there's avenues out there, Craigslist. I got a guy who I don't know who he is or what he really does, but I've had him call me and he gives me lease possibilities in all these places. And I've literally countered. He tells me the price and I tell him, you can cut that in half and I'll think about it. And he goes, let me talk to the owner. And he'll call me back and be like, all right, well, there was one, I was about ready to secure it in. And he called me back and told me that $14 had been killed off the property. And I was like, I'm good, man. I'm going to do some other avenue. That's a little bit too much hunting pressure for the year. And it was a late season hunt too. So, but that's the other thing too, is if you're looking for that rut hunt beginning in November, yeah, you're probably not going to get a discount with any of these outfitters. If you're looking for early season or late season, especially when these guys are basically tapped out, they don't have any clientele coming in. That's when you can kind of do that stuff. But like I said, I'm a big public land guy. You know, a lot of these places I go, I do the public land stuff. Very mobile. Even a lot of times we're mobile on where we stay just because we don't know if the area is going to be that great or not, if we haven't scouted it in the past. And so I always look down those avenues, but it doesn't mean that that's the avenue I'm going to take. Like we're leaving for Kansas on Friday. The funny thing is we actually do have I've got two numbers of private guys, but because I've hunted the public land around there and ran into these locals and, you know, and sat and had a conversation with them, there's one guy who he kept driving up and down while we were hunting this piece of public, which is Weehaw out there, which is private land that's open to the public. And he ended up waving us down and started talking to us. 15 minutes later, we're riding around his pickup truck. He's showing us all his private property. And he's like, you know, if you guys want to hunt this, go ahead. And it's like, you know, that stuff doesn't happen on a daily basis. So that's why I always welcome talking to the locals, or like you said, the local guy in the bar says, I got 100 acres down the road that you can hunt whenever you want. No one hunts it. And, you know, I actually got a phone call today from a guy in Iowa that I ran into 3 years ago. I killed my Iowa buck on his property this year, and I hit a buck on public and it ran onto private. In Iowa, you can legally go onto private and track your wounded animal. You just can't bring your weapon with you. Me being from Michigan, that just didn't feel right. It just didn't sit right. The guy, I could see the guy's tree stands. I could see his box blinds. I knew he was a hunter. So I tracked the owner down. While I was tracking the owner down, I ran into some guy on a dirt road while I was going back there. And I told him the whole story. And he's like, you don't need to do that. You can just go get your deer. And I said, yeah, it just doesn't feel right. He goes, you know what? He goes, you sound like a good guy. He goes, I got a 150-acre farm. You can hunt whenever you want. And I hunted it late season that Iowa because I ended up not finding that buck. And then I hunted it this year as well with my buddy. And the guy called me today. He's coming to Michigan. He was going to see if I was in town and stuff. And so it's those relationships that you develop with these guys. And, you know, one of the rules in my book that I talk about is you just talk to everybody and anybody. You never know what avenue is going to take to put you on the next piece of beautiful hunting ground that you're going to have an experience of a lifetime in.
So you touched on a couple of different things there. One, so let's say you get that piece of property for $250 or whatever for late season, late archery. Do you feel, or I guess a better way to frame it would be, how do you combat the feeling of feeling like I paid for this, so I have to stay here? You know, I feel like you would be more inclined, I guess you'd be less inclined to go to public or to bounce around if you paid money to hunt this ground, which may be 100 acres or, you know, whatever. How do you combat that?
Combat it by, you know, wanting to put yourself on deer. If I go down there and there's no deer there, I'm going to move on. And first and foremost, a lot of these properties, you know, e-scouting goes a long way. And there's a lot to be said. Yeah, you're not going to know any finer details. You're not going to, you know, you're not going to know that kind of stuff. But, you know, I had hunted the area, the county in the past, and, you know, I had known that, but I'm never tied to a piece. I mean, you go hunt public land. If you're going solely hunting public land in another state, you're not tied to that area. You might be traveling 2 hours to go get on deer, and it's, you know, it's just like fishing. You're not getting bit, you move on. And same thing with deer hunting. And so, and that's the other thing too, is if I paid $1,500 or $2,000, I'm going to hunt that property and figure it out. If I pay $250, all right, move on. If I get there and strike out, I'm going to move on. I might throw a trail camera on it and go for 2 days, go hunt something else on public and keep scouting and venturing, and come back and check it and see if I'm missing something that's going on there or not. But no, I'm not tied to anything. You can't be. I mean, if just because you've got a good stand on a piece of property, you know, you killed a buck there last year, does not mean by any means, you know, it could get logged on the backside this year. You know, it doesn't mean, you know, it's a guarantee. And same thing with just paying money for it. And that's kind of one of the things is like, all right, can I afford to go on a $3,000 hunt? Sure. But do I want to pay $3,000 to go on a hunt? No, not at all. I'd rather work a little bit harder for it and pay less and go on another $700 hunt down the road in the same season. This year I've got 6 buck tags. I've got 3 filled so far, and 5 different states, Michigan, we get 2 buck tags. So, you know, and I'm actually toying with the idea, don't tell my wife yet, but about going to Kentucky later this year. So there's, you know, I'm always looking for what other experience can I have? What other area can I go to? You know, even if I say I go to Kentucky and we strike out, it's still a learning experience for maybe next year. I get it kind of dialed in a little bit more, and we get something figured out, and it's a huge learning curve. I mean, I haven't shot a buck in Ohio, which is crazy, but I haven't shot a buck in Ohio. I was thinking about it the other day. I think it's been like 8 years, and I hunted every single year. And so it's, and I have opportunities almost every single year, whether I let them walk or what I want to do. But, you know, every year it gets a little bit more fine tuned on higher probability of actually killing a deer, in all these different areas. So,
for the guys that are just starting out trying to do their first out-of-state hunt. So if you were starting your first out-of-state hunt today, knowing what you know now, how would you, like, walk us through the steps of planning that hunt from, like, time of year, budgeting, lodging, and we'll just, for ease of the scenario, we're going to say that you're going to plan that quintessential rut hunt and kind of go from there. But if you think that there's a better place or a better way to do that, where, I mean, because I feel like the times that I've done it, it's been, okay, we're going to leave on Halloween, and then it's going to be, we're going to leave the week after, and then we run into guys and we're trying to figure that out. So, you know, like I said, knowing what you know now, and in a guy's mind, he says, I want to hunt the rut hunt. But in reality, what he's saying is he wants the most opportunities at deer of a certain caliber, right? So
yeah,
so
no, I get it. Yeah, I mean, A lot of it comes down to is looking at your time off. I mean, family, you know, all of that kind of stuff, that all comes kind of into play. When I first started doing this, November 15th was a holiday, you know, in my mind was a holiday in Michigan. So I wanted to be back by November 15th. I've kind of gotten away from that for the time being. But, you know, if you want to go for that rut hunt, and typically with my hunts each year, so I'm hunting five different states this year, the best state that I'm going to hunt, I'm going to go during that rut week. Now, granted, with that being said, like you just said, when everybody plans a hunt, they're going from Halloween to November 14th, especially if they're from Michigan, that's when they're going. Some of these other states, like in November, in Iowa, guys really don't even start hunting out there until after like the 12th, 14th, 15th. That's when they start kind of breaking loose a lot of times with the rut. But you're going to run into more pressure if you're hunting public land that way. Absolutely. If you're going to hunt private land with an outfitter or something along those lines, you're going to be paying top dollar. That's just bottom line, because you're talking about the best time to go. But a lot of that comes down to, you know, deciding on the time. And if you decide that rut's your time, the other thing that I would suggest is don't go outside. If it's your first time, don't go outside your boundary. If you're from Michigan, more than likely you're a stand hunter. You're a box blind hunter. You're not a guy who goes and covers 15 miles a day and tries to spot and stalk deer. Don't go out west. Not for your first time. Just because hunt with what you're comfortable with, hunt within your means of what you know. And if you're going to hunt public land during that time frame, you know, as much as the cat's out of the bag with Ohio. I mean, yeah, 15 years ago, it was great. There was very few people down there. I've moved on from spots where I shot a 6x6. I shot a 12 point down there on public land, and there, you can't get a parking spot within 2 miles of the area at this point. And, you know, there's guys from Pennsylvania, New York, all over the place. And, so there's something to be said about that. But the other thing too, is if you're deciding that that's what you want to do, the time of starting to plan that is right now for next year. Like right now we're in December. You need to know where you want to go for next year. We're going to be having that conversation with the guys that I'm going down to Kansas with on the trip down. We're going to be talking about what our options are for next year. I've got points in for Colorado. I've got points in for Wyoming. I've got points in for Montana, Kentucky elk. You know, planning 2-3 years out is ideal. And if you want to put together a hunt next year, that's fine. That's great. And you need to start planning now. And, the real reason I say that is the best time to scout is March. Go shed hunt those areas. You know, you might not find a shed. That's not the point. A lot of these areas, like Indiana, they have a law. You got to pull your stands down. In Michigan, you walk around public land, you see stands all over the place. Same in Ohio, you see them all year round down there. Even though I think you're supposed to pull them, but you can go down there and nobody's hunting. You can see where the pressure has been throughout the year. You can see old scrapes. Sometimes they're still active in February. I've seen that in March. And you can see old rub lines. You can start getting an idea. And February and March is such an overtime look for scouting. And if you can, obviously Kansas, it's a little bit too far. Iowa's not far. Ohio's not far. Indiana's not far. You can make a long weekend trip out of those scouting trips and kind of attack those. But that's where that kind of comes down to. And then the other thing is too, is, you know, if you don't know what state you want to go to, kind of set your budget. You got the one price I talk about in my book that you never get around is a tag. You've got to pay for that. And you also got to look to see if there's preference points that come into play. Ohio's over the counter. Indiana's over the counter. You talk Kansas, Iowa, you need points. You know, you might not draw the first year, but there's spots in Iowa where you can draw a gun tag every single year, but you can't draw an archery tag, which is really odd. But if you go gun hunt Iowa, you'll learn why. But there's all those kind of things that kind of come into play with what you want to do. And then if you decide that, you know, okay, we're going to go to Ohio, we're going to go during rut, and we're going to go scout in February and March, you basically kind of already got your game plan going. At the end of March, then you kind of have maybe two or three areas that you really want to look at come before that rut. A lot of times what I'll do is Ohio. I shot a buck on Indiana public land this year, but I'd spent scouting it for 2 years, and I only hunted in Indiana for one day this year before shooting my buck. It was the first sit I had, first morning I had, but that was 2 years of planning with that. So a lot of that comes down to is you got those three areas, then you can start looking for lodging. The earlier you lock things in, a lot of times you get discounts with lodging. Like the spot we're going to Kansas, it's $95 a guy for 8 days. It's dirt cheap. I locked it in March, or as soon as Kansas came through that we drew, I locked it in that day. So all that kind of comes into play. And then the, if it's Ohio and it's only a 4 or 5 hour trip, you might want to think about, late September going down and hanging cameras, or even mid October where it gets a little bit closer. We've done that. Be prepared for about 50% of them to get stolen, SD cards getting stolen. A lot of times I take that as high hunting pressure in the area. Kind of gives me a little insight. When I have a camera that's got good bucks on it and it hasn't been stolen or touched, you're into something good. And then when time comes, you go and actually do the hunt, and you're basically at a pretty low budget cost hunt for a couple trips and not far from home.
So one of the things you mentioned in the book, and you kind of didn't go into that there as far as planning, but party size. So how many guys do you want to bring with you? And I think it's really difficult I think anybody that really hunts hard or hunts a certain way, it's really easy to, run into a guy who says, "Yeah, I hunt all the time. I'm a hunter too." And when you get to talking to him, you guys, maybe just like what you were talking about with the outfitter, landowner, dollar amounts, you're not on the same wavelength as what hunting hard is. So in party size or how many guys to bring with you, what have you run into over the years?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Actually, I completely missed that when putting together hunt. That's my first rule in the book is, who are you going to go with? And a lot of how you're going to hunt depends on who you're going to go with. I've got buddies where, all right, this is going to be a fun hunt. If I'm going with this guy, we're going to have fun. We're not going to hunt extremely hard. This is more about a life experience is what's going to happen. And I've got other guys like, you're getting up at 4 a.m. You're going to bed at 8:30 at night because you're going to be exhausted. The best that I've found is hunting in parties of two, two to a truck. You can go with six guys, take three trucks, go two, two, and two. If you start to go with three in a truck, you start to run in, three's a crowd. You start to run into, okay, if you're stand hunting, there's always going to be the last guy picked up, the first guy dropped off a little bit too early or something along those lines. If he shoots, then it's a mess to try to get everybody coordinated, get the deer out. And you're on a hunt, so if a buddy shoots, yeah, you're pumped up, you're excited for them, but you also want, you might be on a limited hunt where you're only hunting 5 days or you're only hunting 6 days and wasting a whole day to help someone track a deer, which you do. I mean, that's what you do. But if you're hunting in groups of two, you and your partner are focused with yourselves. And so the best hunting trips I've taken, when we're going to Kansas, we're leaving on Friday. There's four of us. There's two in each truck. This year it's me and my dad and then my buddy and his son. And we're going out there. And when we go out there, we go our separate ways. We're still hunting as a team and figuring things out of how things are going, but they kind of got their areas that they go hunt. And this is my fourth year out in Kansas this year, but And we've got our areas that we're going to go focus on. So when it comes down to it, you know, your whole trip is going to be determined whether it's successful if you shoot one, or if you just have fun time, or if it's completely miserable because of who you actually went with. So you want to be very mindful of who you're going on this trip with, and take that in consideration. So I'm going on the trip with, my dad hasn't been to Kansas. He went the first year we went, 4 years ago, and we were doing a ton of walking. We do about 15 miles a day. Well, about Wednesday, 5-6 days into that hunt, my dad was he was toast. And now I've hunted out there a few times. I have a lot of spots that I can sit in the mornings and sit in the evenings and not just be constantly moving throughout the entire day. So I've got that already in that mindset already going with my dad that, you know, we're going to be doing a lot of sitting when we're out there in Kansas. I've got these spots that, you know, I know deer travel through. Like the last time I was out there, you know, 11 o'clock, there were still deer funneling in through this area. And my dad's from Michigan, hunted Michigan his whole life. Lot more of a stand sitter. Let's grind this out. Actually, in my book, I talk about grinders and finders. Like if I was going out with one of my best friends, Ryan, if we were going out there, we'd be on the finder mode and we'd be putting on that 15 miles every single day. And we'd be covering ground. With my dad, I'm being very mindful that we're going to go out there and we're going to be a little bit more on the grinder side. But with that being said, the pressure out in Kansas has been increasing a ton. So covering much more ground, a lot more ground every single day, you end up running into a lot more hunters. Last year with COVID, it was nuts. There was more hunters out there than I've ever seen. That was the third year out there, and it was just, there was guys everywhere. So
this is, like a tough place to ask this question. It's a tough, it is, very much like, an anomaly, like an oxymoron to like ask this. Right. But like,
I don't know where you're going with this. You're kind of scaring me.
So it sounds like you've been hunting out of state and doing this yourself for, you know, the better part of two decades, you know, 16 years plus something is what I'm surmising. How has social media, podcasts, YouTube changed what you found? You know, you kind of led into it there with like COVID and, you know, people having more time off. But right now, there are a couple of different camps, right? So there is, and you had said it earlier on that, you know, we're all on the same team, hunt however you want to hunt. But then there's the other part of it, like where the best example is like the ugly American, right? So there's the hunters that throw all their garbage out there. There's the hunters that, you know, walk past you at prime time. And, you know, so there's a very not same team attitude there as well. So how has that changed your planning of your hunts? And has it changed, you know, you'd mentioned, you know, you still want to be in your best state at the best date. But has that changed pressure, properties? Has it changed the best date, the best time, you know, as you've worked through this process?
Yeah, honestly, what it's changed is how hard you've got to work, is what it really comes down to. With social media, you know, you talk about the YouTube channels out there that, you know, the hunting public, you know, what are guys doing when they're watching that? They're trying to figure out, oh, did I see a street sign there? I saw an Onyx map. There was a river name on there. I just did it the other day on a hunt that I was watching. I saw a river name out in Kansas. I was like, is that in the area that I'm going? You know, so there's a lot of things that the cat's out of the bag. And like I said, in Ohio, 15 years ago, Ohio was awesome. I mean, there was, yeah, there was still a lot of state hunters and there was still pressure down there. But there wasn't the type of numbers that are down there. There's an area in Ohio that I won't even go anymore. And it followed my steps that I lay out for going to a new state, looking at, you know, big buck counties, looking at the public land areas. It followed that to a T, and it's like I said, there's not even the one time that we were there, there was a camper parked in the spot, where I had never seen anybody park before. And so the terms of hunting, which is awesome. I mean, I want to see as many people get into hunting as I can. It's more people on our team. I know people that feel different because there's less area to hunt if that's the case. But the way I feel is the more people that are out there hunting, you know, the more people that are on our team about how to do this and do it. Now, with that being said, there are people that don't go about it the right way. Like you said, throw trash out there, you know, shoot anything under the sun. You know, I saw movement, so I shot into the brush. There's always those type of guys. You know, those are the type of guys you don't want to go on the trip with. If you're a type of guy who wants to go on a trip and have a bunch of beers and, you know, maybe two nights out of your seven, you don't wake up the next morning, you sleep in, hey, that's fine. Just find somebody who wants to do that kind of hunting when you go on that trip. You know, when I go, I need a vacation from my vacation when I get back. Like I'm exhausted, work my tail off, you know, and that's the other thing too, is that, you know, I never put, a tape measure on my antlers. I don't care really what it comes down to is score. You know, granted, I want to shoot the biggest buck I could possibly shoot on any type of trip, but a lot of it comes down to some of the memories. I was telling you earlier, my daughter shot a 5-point. It was her first buck. She's 9 years old. One of the coolest experiences of my life. And, you know, the deer scores 35 inches. I don't know, you know, something absolutely ridiculous. But you know, so some of those with those hunts, you know, it comes down to memories and stuff like that. But social media, you know, Onyx Maps, HuntWise, all that kind of stuff. If you had a secret spot, it's not really much of a secret anymore. It really comes down to hunting areas that are hard to get to, some areas that are overlooked. Those are sometimes, you know, actually that 12 point I shot in Ohio, I shot it about 250 yards from the parking spot. We had other guys hunting it and they'd walk right by. And we saw bucks there all day long. So there, you know, there's all those kind of technology. I talked about e-scouting. Everybody can do that. You get Google Earth, you get on there, you start doing e-scouting. All of that has enhanced our ability to be more successful in the field and give everybody opportunities. Everybody likes an easy hunt, sure. But like I said, some of my favorite hunts I've ever been on are those hard ones. We went to North Dakota, that year they switched the non-resident from being able to shoot mule deer or whitetail, to whitetail only. And, we were actually, when we had planned all this out, the year before, we were planning on going into a more mule deer area early season. We wanted to go after velvet mule deer is what we really wanted to go for. Well, we had kind of had all these things into place where we were kind of committed to going over to this side of the state. And when we got over there, man, me and my cousin, we spent two solid days looking for whitetails anywhere else. There was no other whitetails other than this one area where every non-resident hunter was hunting because it was all whitetails, and it was tough. There was guys everywhere. The game warden was around there daily because why not? There's 50 non-resident hunters hunting, you know, everywhere. And we saw them give guys tickets for, you know, driving their truck too far back and stuff like that. But, we went 1-for-4. I was the only one who shot one. I shot an 8-point and it was probably about a, I don't know, 110 inch 8-point, and I'm proud as a peacock. And it goes down as, you know, one of my most memorable hunts on public land somewhere else. But just because the rack wasn't big doesn't mean on how successful the hunt actually was.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I think you open with in your book, is that the success of a hunt isn't, I forget how you highlighted it, but isn't based on like the inches of the rack, but more like on the memories made. And I feel like when we hunt around home, this example of like when I went up with my family to our camp in the UP and it was a rifle hunt and all the kids were there and I hunted probably just as hard as I would have given any other circumstances, but the outcome really didn't matter. It was for the kids. And, I wanted to get back to be with my daughter to be like, hey, what did you want to do? Did you see anything out the window? Did you, that sort of experience. And that was a more fulfilling hunt than a lot of the all day grinded out sits where you're seeing a bunch of deer, but they're not the deer, or you walked in all this way and you scouted and you saw a deer, and it's just way different. And so when you talk about those types of different hunts, like when we went on our first elk hunt, it was completely DIY. Local told us, go here, here's some spots to check out, there you go. And we wanted to hear an elk, see an elk, and get an opportunity, and we got all of that in spades, and it was one of the most memorable trips, but we didn't come home with anything. And, obviously there's, you spend a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of vacation time away from your family, but we often forget that, just because we can't post that trophy picture on Instagram or whatever, that doesn't mean that it wasn't a successful hunt, So a little bit of your insight on that.
Yeah. I completely agree. It's honestly, going back to your social media question, I think a lot of that ruins a lot of, there's always going to be negative feedback, period, no matter what you do. I've always said, if you're not getting negative feedback, you're not doing something right, because you're just going to always get that. And so I watched one of my younger cousins growing up, and, he'd shoot a 6-point and it was his first deer, and he got razzed at school for shooting a little buck and stuff like that. And, part of that is kind of ruined, some of the expectation of what the real purpose is of hunting, and kind of takes away from a lot of that. And, like you said, with your elk hunt, one of my definition of a successful hunt is that one person in my group that I put a hunt together has an opportunity. That's it. It isn't that we all fill tags. It isn't that we all kill deer. Granted, the hunts that we all kill deer, yeah, that's a home run. And, there's definitely some more memories there. 3 years ago, I drew my first Iowa tag, and it was one of those hunts where it's hardcore. Like we're hunting all day, every single day. I ended up making 3 trips to Iowa. I hunted 16 days. I ended up hitting a buck and not getting it. And I saw over 85 different bucks. Just had one of the most memorable experiences. I drew my Iowa tag this year and went out with the same buddy, and we were talking about it, and he's like, yeah, we didn't shoot 3 years ago, but he goes, I wouldn't trade that hunt for anything. Like it was absolutely memorable. It was the experiences that we had, the people that we ran into, just all around, it was so memorable, and I'll never forget it. And that's for sure. And, and I hunted my tail off. Now there's other trips too, where, you take your kid out, you take your daughter out, and, you hunt for 15 minutes and, they're like, I want to go, I'm cold, I want to go in, and it's still memorable, but in a different way. So it's definitely not all about killing deer. It's not all about antlers. You know, granted, that's the goal. That's what you're setting out to do. And if you're not setting out to do that, then you're basically just going out and traveling and sightseeing and hiking. But the real success story is, you know, you have memories, you have a good time, and you have fun. And you know, that's what it really comes down to. My dad and I have gone and we've taken trips to Nebraska. It was a really hard trip, but I got to spend time with my dad one-on-one for an entire week. He ended up shooting a small 8-point towards the end of the week. We hunted our tail off, but it was, you know, it was very memorable. It doesn't come down to the inches of the antler, and that goes for a long way. I mean, anybody who has shot a buck can tell you that entire story, probably too long of a story about that first buck, too detailed, because it's so memorable. And, you know, so anytime, the one thing I like to do is I like to go to these new states. I like to, you know, my wife knows my goal is to hunt or fish in all 50 states, you know, whether I do it or not, I don't know. But you know, I did a hog hunt in Florida. She wants to go on spring break next year down to Myrtle Beach. All I'm doing is looking for a turkey hunt, something to, you know, go do down there. You know, there's all different reasons why a hunt will be memorable, and it doesn't always have to be for the size of the antler that you're on the hunt with.
And so, interestingly enough, one of our Patreons had asked about hog hunting, right? So is there a budget way to do that, or how would you plan that hunt?
So, all right, I've only planned one hog hunt, and my family wanted to go to Florida for spring break. And I was like, all right, I'm like, I can't sit next to a pool or a beach for 7 days and not go absolutely crazy. So I took the same mentality on how I do my deer hunts. I actually reached out to the place we were staying at the Airbnb and knew if the lady knew anybody, and she actually did. So she knew a guy who did bow fishing off an airboat, and that intrigued me. And I thought about down that line, but I started talking to him about hog hunting. We kind of worked through some things. He had a buddy that wanted to get into guiding and hadn't really had any clients, and it wasn't going to work because they were picking the groves of where we could hunt, and I wanted to bow hunt only. The farmer wouldn't let me hunt in the daylight, so we could only hunt at night because they were picking the groves. So that didn't work out. So he sent me into a high fence ranch. And so I called them and I told them, I'm like, look, I don't want to kill one in the fence. And if guys want to kill hogs in the fence and, you know, kill deer in the fence, whatever, hey, they're still hunting. It's still legal. That's their prerogative. It's just not for me. And so I called him up and I was like, you know, I want a bow hunt and I want to hunt free range. And he's like, we can do that. And so they own a bunch of acres outside the high fence with a bunch of hogs on them. I ended up not shooting one. I missed one. I took a shot at 35 yards just as twilight was setting in. And when I got there, you could tell that they weren't really, they're more for the guys inside the high fence. But I ended up calling down there, talking to them, you know, telling them I wanted to bow hunt. And I didn't, you know, it wasn't one of those situations where I could really beat them up with price. Cause I was kind of tied down to the area I was going. I wasn't willing to walk away and go hunt public land. But it ended up, I think it was still only like, I don't know, $250 or $300. It wasn't anything crazy. I ended up seeing two hogs. They really never came. They never put stuff in the feeder. I was hunting out of some rinky ladder stand. Like I was just completely out of my own world. It wasn't, but if I had to do it again, I'd probably still call these guys and, you know, they would, I know a lot more going into it now. And the same thing with deer hunting, take that same expectation is, you know, your first year, you might have four guys going, you might not do anything, any good. But the following year, you've already learned so much going into it than what you know for the next year, and the same thing. So if I ever went and did it again, you know, I'd probably talk to that bow hunt guy or the bow fishing guy again and try to get in to, however I could do some of that stuff or whatnot. But it's, you know, not everything goes according to plan. Just because you pay money doesn't mean you're going to kill something. Hog hunting is, I don't know. I don't know much about it. I'm not going to be the first one to tell you I know anything about it. And, I just took the same mentality of how I put together a deer hunt. But like I said, I was tied into the area. I had the small window, you know, Tuesday to Thursday where I could break away from the family for a day and, try to go do something to put my mind at ease and get in the woods. But it was still fun. I'd still do it again. The guys who hunted in the high fence, so when I got there, there was four rifle hunters and they were hunting high fence and they went sighted in the rifles and the guy took me on the gator and we drove outside the fence way back into the swamp and he dropped me off and said, good luck. And, I heard all of them shoot in the first 15, 20 minutes and they had hogs hanging when I got back. And, you know, I'm okay with that. It doesn't bother me at all. It doesn't bother me one bit that I didn't get one. They hunt a high fence and they got it. You know, that doesn't bother me. That's my hunting style and that's what I prefer.
So in your hunting style, like, what is your hunting, like, preferred mobile type setup? Because it sounds like your mobile public land style isn't that much different from what we do. So what is your setup and then what's your bow setup as well?
So I'm kind of like, I like to have the most tools. I've had a guy tell me that, oh, I got rid of all my hang on stands because I got a saddle and he's like, I'll never hunt on anything else. And I said, okay, you know, so I've got a Latitude saddle and, I love it. There's a time and place for it and I use it frequently. But I didn't get rid of all my other setups. I have a Lone Wolf climber, hand climber, really light. Like you said earlier, I videotape everything I do. So I've got camera equipment, I've got camera arms, I've got all that kind of stuff. So light is very important to me. But I also have a Lone Wolf hang on with sticks that mount onto it. If I'm going in for an all day sit, me personally, I take my Lone Wolf and I sit in a stand if I can. If I might be mobile, like if I'm going to go and I might hunt this area for 2 hours and I might get down and go jump if, you know, bucks are rutting and I see all the movement, you know, 250 yards away, I don't really know, have a game plan going into an area. I take my saddle. Absolutely. I shot my buck in Indiana on public land out of my saddle this year, just because it was so far back in and I just needed to be as light as possible to get back in there. Yeah, I had to go through a swamp. I was wet up to my crotch getting into the stand in the morning. So, you know, it just all like you hunt Southern Ohio. There's a lot of climber trees down there. All right. I prefer my sticks and my hang on, light hang on or my saddle over my climber. Now, actually, I think this year I haven't used my climber one time. I've kind of gotten away from it a little bit. There's still a time and place. When I go on these trips, I take my saddle, I take my platform for that. And I take my hang on with my sticks that are on the stand. And then I also take my, my climber. And then I usually always take another set of sticks and a hang on. If I got a spot that I might go hang that right when I get there, not think about it for 3 days and go bounce into it. If I had that spot previously scouted. So honestly, I use it all. I'm not married to one or the other. If I kill a deer out of the saddle, if I kill a deer out of hang on, or if I kill a deer on the ground, it doesn't matter to me. It's all the time and place on kind of the setup. I love the saddle, over the climber only because I like very covered up trees. I like getting in those little bit of thicker trees where you can get a little way with movement. And that's because of my videotaping. you know, I can get away with a little bit more movement if I've got that cover. If I'm on a, with a climber and I'm on a telephone pole that I got to climb up with no branches on, you know, you're always, you know, thinking about the backdrop and what's there and what, you know, what kind of movements you can get away with. So there's all that, that kind of comes into play, but, yeah, like I love my saddle, just as much as I love all the other ones, but they're just, as much as I hate to say the phrase, it's just another tool in the toolbox where, you know, if it's making me a successful hunter, I'm going to use it.
And which Latitude saddle?
I got the classic. I think it's classic.
Okay. Yeah. That's what I run. John runs the Method. He's got the Method 2XL. My brother's been running the Method. Hunted out of a lot of saddles.
I put it in the backyard the first year I got it and, you know, practiced on shooting out of it. And it's awesome. It's great. I did all day sit, no knee pads. One of the first years of hunting with a saddle, I did an all day sit down in Ohio and I was miserable, man. I was absolutely miserable. And, that's when I was like, all right, if I do an all, like, I don't have the extra back harness or anything like that. I'm like, which would help and knee pads would help. I'm like, if I'm doing all day sit, I'd like to sit down for a couple hours when things are dead, which I stand, I would say when I hunt, I'm standing probably 80% of the time anyways, just because one of my rules is if I ever look at my phone, whether it be text or you're bored and you're actually looking at your phone, I have to be standing. Because when I'm recording and videotaping, it's standing up is one less step I have to do if I get caught off guard, if a deer's coming in. I sat in that saddle all day long and my back hurt pretty bad by the end of the day. And that's when I was like, I should buy that extra back brace if I decide to do that again.
And so what bow are you shooting and what's your arrow setup and all that?
Yeah, so I'm shooting an Elite Ritual. Absolutely love it. And then I'm shooting, Victory, vapes, arrows. I actually was at a film festival and I won a half dozen of those Victory arrows. And, I was shooting some other type of arrow and I was shooting my bow and I picked up those and it blew through my target. The penetration was insane. So I ended up using those. I shoot, this year I actually made a change and I shoot G5s, those Mecha Meats. I was blown away. I usually don't change my broadheads. I was a big Rage guy. I know there's, you know, polarized views on Rages, through the internet and social medias. That's basically my setup. I got a CBE, sight and, QAD drop away. And I shoot four finger release. A lot of that four finger release for me is because of recording. If I shoot a wrist strap, the deer moves and you got to move the camera. You got to unclick, move the camera and then click back on. Whereas my four finger can hang on my D loop and I can move the camera and then just grab the release again. And I still see a lot of guys videotaping that are using the release, the wrist strap. And, you know, it's so much easier to not be able to use that, but I prefer the four finger, release over that as well.
Okay. So, for the listeners, like where can they find the book? Where can they follow along with you? You know, if they got questions, they want more information, like how can they reach out to you? Where can they get this stuff?
Yeah. So the book is on Amazon, exclusively. It's, The Non-Resident Hunter, obviously by Blake Mallory and, how to destination deer hunt on a budget. And I think it's $9.99 right now. And, it's also free on, if you have an Amazon subscription through Kindle. So it's free that avenue. And then anybody can ever reach out to me. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. And then also a lot of my videos are on Michigan Whitetail Pursuit. The buck I killed this year in Michigan is on there. The one I killed in Indiana and the one I killed in Iowa aren't yet. we come out with Michigan Whitetail Pursuit on the Road. And we usually come out with those after the season and put together a DVD on that as well. Yeah, when I came into Michigan Whitetail Pursuit, a lot of it was, you know, solely based on Michigan. And, you know, I had a lot of in-depth conversations about, you know, all the non-resident hunting I do, all the out-of-state stuff I do, and how we kind of wanted to pursue that avenue of having those videos out there. You know, I had conversations that I'll do my own thing, you know, because I videotape all those hunts that I go on. We ended up, you know, a lot of guys from Michigan are always looking to go out of state and do other things. And so we kind of opened up that avenue of Michigan Whitetail Pursuit on the Road. So we have, I think we have one DVD out, one season of On the Road as of right now. And we have some more episodes that are out there that we didn't put together a DVD last year because of COVID on the road. I think there was only a few of us that actually went out and actually got some stuff that were out of state, but this year we definitely got some stuff in the works of hunts on video for out of state.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on. And I think people are really going to, I mean, the fact that it's free for Amazon Kindle and $10 going into the holiday season, I mean, $10 stocking stuff for, like, tell your wife, tell your girlfriend.
I didn't write this to get rich or anything like that. My dad, I was talking to him, I was like, man, I should write a book about how I put these together. And he's like, yeah, you should. And I just did it. And honestly, I did it for myself. I wrote it, you know, every book that sells, I'm like, all right, that's kind of cool. You know, like I'm by no means were, you know, trying to make a living on writing this book, but there's some details in there about some areas that I hunt, and you know, I'm an open book. You know, if someone asks me a question, I tell them exactly, you know, I might give them the pin to where I was hunting, but I tell people what county I was hunting in and whatnot. And you know, I love to see more people getting into it and more people taking advantage of the opportunity that's out there.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you coming on, and thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Adam. Thank you. Mm-hmm.